Welcome to the 19th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as the English cricket season draws to a close, we're getting our final fix of county cricket before the long winter.
And what a last few weeks it's been. We're sorry to have been off air for so long. Certain members of Reverse Threat Radio have been
carrying out investigative research into the resurgence of cricket in Cuba.
And what were the results of the research?
Well, interesting fact, Churchill was very confident that cricket was going to make it big in Cuba. Unfortunately, they just basically... Baseball was easy, it was simpler, there were a lot of Americans around the place.
Churchill was confident of many things that didn't come off. Now, one thing that
World War II broadly came off.
One thing that he might have been confident in was a resurgence of this India side in the One Dayers.
That's a beautiful, link.
Which I think a lot of us did, were quite confident in. Here was a side that had won the World Cup, but a few months before the series. However, they seem to have carried over some of their ineptitude into the One Day series.
It's interesting, isn't it? Quite often, you can distinguish quite clearly. You have the Test series, you have the One Days, and the sort of dynamic between the sides can be very different between the two. Yep. In this summer, it really has sort of carried on. I mean, England have looked very dominant, and that sort of lack of commitment that we had from India in the Test series seems to have continued.
Well, I remember that when we talked about the Australia One Days back in January 2011, we compared them to the South Africa-England One Days the year before, in the summer before, and there was a sort of always a sense of after the Lord Mayor's show, and England had done well in the series, actually, against South Africa, they'd done badly. But it was always the reverse, the result always reversed
in
the One Day series.
And it almost gives a beaten Test side an opportunity to kind of bounce back. India haven't necessarily looked that bothered about bouncing back. I mean, there's been some quite... I mean, very interesting thing was a player like Suresh Raina, who the Test series really, in many ways, was a humiliation for Raina. That pair at the Oval really bring to an end a difficult series for him. And suddenly, you put him in the One Day International pyjamas and he's got his swagger back, his confidence. It's odd how a format can do that.
But similarly, one of the things that I think has made England so successful is the fact that they have abandoned this ridiculous idea they had all the way through the 90s and the early 2000s, which is you had a Test side and then you had a One Day side that was completely different. And you got the Jamie Dalrymples and the Ricky Clarks and the Luke Wrights, whose wonderful figures were what, a batting average of 22
right.
And a bowling average of 58?
Yeah.
Was that
yeah.
it? And so what England have said is, look, we're going to get rid of these bits and pieces players. We're going to align the Test and the One Day side. This has had the benefit of allowing the momentum of the Test series to be carried on into the One Day series. It also means that it enables you to approach One Day cricket in a less kind of Luke Wright fashion, which is the kind of sometimes
yeah,
it comes off,
it's
sometimes
odd.
It doesn't.
I mean, maybe someone will one day write the definitive book on England's bits and pieces cricket, because it was a sort of fetish amongst the selectors.
Rather you than me, the fetish.
Right, well,
of
it was sort of a fetish amongst the selectors that we needed
number one
those
on the
players to kind of balance the side. Well, I'm sure fetish is very well searched on Amazon, but anyway, they kind of would balance the side. Well, that was the feeling. And what seems to have been, it's quite an old-fashioned principle, actually. The idea that now seems to have won out is your best players are your best players. We were chatting about it before the show, and with the exception of Craig Kiesvetter, England's top order in the One Days, if they were fully fit, if everyone was fully fit, would pretty much be their Test order.
What's been interesting, though, is having seen England bat without Morgan and Peterson in their lineup, both for varying reasons. Peterson, slightly mysteriously, being dropped, rested, whatever the word that is they want to use for the
If it was another player, side. You'd be relaxed about. With Peterson, you assume something fishy, don't you?
You do, and you assume that he smashed a few paintings in the long room afterwards. But it's been interesting seeing England back without Morgan and Peterson, and it's been interesting seeing some of the players who have come up to fill their place, one of them being Ravi Bapara, who I think during the Test series we all felt very sorry for, because he came in that horrible position at Edgbaston in Birmingham,
I don't think it would be going too far to say Bapara may well have saved his international career with this India series. Before you accuse me of rampant overstatement, I think if you imagine a scenario where he came into this One Day side, really struggled, and Morgan comes back, Peterson comes back, there's actually very little reason to envisage him coming back.
You sort of think that England have given You would have thought after that that England would have given Papara enough chances. Mm. So they've played him at three in an Ashes series. He's done appallingly. They've played him in a Test series. He hasn't really had a chance. They would have played him in a One Day series, yeah. And he wouldn't have done well. But he has. You're right. He sort of stood up and
his 96 at Lord's, his 40 at the Oval, both shared the fact that they were made in difficult situations. England were struggling. They needed someone to play sensibly. They weren't outrageous One Day innings. They weren't rampant pace innings. But they were both very carefully compiled.
There are other England batsmen who are knocking on the door. There are some.
One of them's actually entered the door.
One of them has entered the door, to stretch a metaphor a bit far. James Taylor was one who remained on the doorstep, mm-hmm. knocked and didn't get in. Stokes is one who knocked, got in, and once he got in, realised that there wasn't much going on in the house.
Right, the metaphor has been extended breaking point.
Let's stop this.
But Ben, I mean, how do you? He's been inside Ben Stokes to
and been into this house.
And what I mean, he a player who has been mentioned again and again on the county circuit, still just 20 years of age. I mean, do you think this selection's been made purely with a view to the future? Or do you think this is some, you know, do you think England see him as part of their current one-day setup? Or
I think England realise that they need to integrate having a really strong current side with bringing players through, and that doesn't mean putting in a crap 12-year-old as part of their team, which it kind of did in the past. They kind of thought, oh, we'll take a speculative gamble on whoever and put them in the side.
To be fair to the insults, I'm not sure they ever selected a crap 12-year-old.
Well, England did with Sachin Tendulkar. But they. What I think has been one of the things that's going to be quite difficult to manage for this England side is that they have got a lot of very good up and coming one day batsmen, of whom Ben Stokes is only one. I mean, there's a whole raft of them.
Yeah.
And one of the difficulties is going to be, so Ben Stokes has got into the side. He hasn't impressed in this series, but he hasn't had the chance to impress. Yeah. And there's a question of how long they keep someone like Stokes in the side, giving him the chance to impress, but at the same time necessarily have to exclude other players who they aren't able to blood.
I wonder, there's an argument for saying, bring new players in when a side is winning. You know, it's a nice environment to be brought into. And I wonder whether the England selectors didn't just feel like, he is a guy who will definitely be an important part of our future. Let's bring him in. Let's give him a go. Let's give him an experience around the setup, and let's see. But generally, the series, well, we're not quite finished yet, but England will win the series, thanks to the rather peculiar tie at the weekend. And it really rounding off an outstanding summer, all in all.
Well, an outstanding summer for England.
An outstanding summer for England. Jetting off to the subcontinent now. And, well, Sri Lanka, Australia, a series that iconically has a very odd feeling to it.
Well, we've been looking forward to it for a lot. I mean, I'm not saying that we were kind of oracles in
salivating
well, you might have been salivating. We were certainly after the Ashes series, we were saying that this Sri Lanka Australia series was going to be a really important gauge of many things. And I'm not quite sure whether it has been an important game.
No,
from anything. Do you think this has been the moment when Australia have kind of reinvented themselves and said, right, post us being number one in the world, this is what we are, you know, and really stamped their assertion?
I think up to this point, after 2005, Australia could legitimately go away from that series saying, we lost it very narrowly, we didn't have Glenn McGrath for most of it, blah, blah, blah. They then smashed England, you know, 5-0, whatever, and Australia were very much, they had the aura, whatever, of a world number one side.
And they were still on the tail end of that decade of dominance.
Exactly. There is no question, though, after the way they were demolished, you know, I really take pleasure in saying that, yep. The way they were demolished in the winter past, that they are now a mediocre average test side who face a long journey back to the top. And this is the first series I think Australia have played for, you know, we're talking maybe 15 years, yep. truly in that position. So in that sense, it's a new dawn. Interestingly, though, there's been less turnover than maybe some expected. Nathan Lyons has joined the sort of ludicrous Aussie spin merry-go-round.
And it's done very well.
Well, I would just say...
He's a spinner playing in the subcontinent.
And he's done very well also on a pitch that has now been reported for how much turn it was offering.
True.
So I think let's wait for the kind of sort of the overall feeling. I mean, what about the Sri Lankans? I mean, they are, much as the Australians are a side sort of on the way back, they're very much a side in transition. I mean, do they have cause for concern?
They are. I'm slightly worried about this Sri Lankan side because they...
Keeps you up at night.
It does keep me up at night. They don't have a body of young players coming through. So, essentially, in this series, they have been comprehensively outplayed in two tests. They won the T20s. The one-day series was just a ludicrous seesaw, where it was kind of... I mean, the victories were by ridiculous margins, kind of eight wickets a time and that. And I don't think there's much you can learn from that one-day series.
No.
It was kind of whoever just went out and had a bit of luck and, and, you know, wore their heart on their sleeve and smashed a few sixes, won. But they have been comprehensively outplayed in these tests, and they've been comprehensively outplayed with a very similar side that came to England.
Mm.
And actually, it's not a side that's been blooding lots of young, new players for next generation.
My main concern, I would argue that the Sri Lankan bowling attack, with the exceptions of probably Bangladesh and probably Zimbabwe, it looks about as unthreatening as any in Test cricket at the moment.
It does.
The seamers in particular look pedestrian.
But at the same time, I would say that from what I've seen of this, of the Test matches, I would say that the Australian batting has been actually very, very good.
Mm.
I think Mike Hussey has looked at his kind of solid... I mean, in the Ashes, when he looks good, he looked really good. He's looked really good in this series. I think the Australian batting lineup's got a really nice balance with Ponting at three and Khawaja at six. It means that they can structure an innings all the way through rather than kind of getting to six and then having kind of hitting and hoping for the rest of it. So, in a sense, I think the frailties of the Sri Lankan bowling lineup, which I'm not denying are there at all, I agree absolutely that they've looked fairly sterile, but I think they've been shown up by a really good
Aussie bat. But I mean, just to add to that, I really don't think until we get Australia get some tougher competition, we can get a real sense of where this side is.
But having said, I mean, I was talking about the strength of the Australian batting lineup, but their bowling has been. I mean, Ryan Harris has looked pretty good.
Yeah,
as well,
I mean, the interesting thing about Ryan Harris is when I first sort of came across him as a cricketer, I really thought trundler. I really thought this is actually an indictment of how Aussie cricket has slipped. I mean, fantastic figures so far. 11 wickets at 14.5 apiece. And also, I thought very interesting to contrast him with Mitchell Johnson, who I certainly saw as the future, really. I saw him as likely to be the talisman of attack. His struggles are very well documented. And frankly, he's increasingly looking like the bit part player, the weak link. I mean, he's taken just four at almost 48 apiece.
I suppose with a player like that, you kind of accept that in order to... You kind of weigh that off, the... You know, taking four at 48 apiece against the times where he's going to bowl a 10-over spell and take 8 for 12.
I would agree with you that he's capable of that, but I think the concern for Australia is it's becoming a really rare event. You know, it's almost become a collector's item.
Yep.
I mean, who's impressed you?
I have for a while. I've had my eye on Angelo Matthews, who has always been known as a one-day player. And what's been quite interesting is that in a batting lineup that's very much floundered for Sri Lanka, he has kind of stepped up with proper test match innings.
Mm.
I mean, in the past, he was able to go out and score 50s off 67 balls and then get out. But he's actually looked quite impressive in this series, I think, in terms of stepping up to the plate.
And gone on and made some scores. So, Zimbabwe and Pakistan... perhaps, you know, the lesser loved of these three series. But, I mean,
ostracised nations in Test cricket at the moment, really, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it came to us, you know, nobody really wanted to go on to tour Zimbabwe and Pakistan said, okay,
and we'll
do it.
And no one wants to go to Pakistan at the moment.
Yeah, so the battle of the unloved. I think we've learned a bit more, though, about where Zimbabwe are now as a Test nation. I mean, I think... I was very impressed. Their ability to put on 412 against a very respectable bowling attack. I mean, you can't help contrasting this with Bangladesh. I mean, there's a solidity about that Zimbabwean batting lineup, you know, that is quite impressive for a side that's only just come back into the arena. I think the big litmus test, they go to New Zealand in the new year, and I think that'll be really interesting because if we're honest, Test cricket is very much divided in two at the moment. We've got the elite at the top, and we've got this sort of Windies, New Zealand, Bangladesh. I was going to say nether regions, but I definitely didn't mean that. Lower league. And yeah, we'll see how Zimbabwe do there.
I don't agree, actually. I think that this Pakistan-Zimbabwe series or Zimbabwe-Pakistan series hasn't told us as much as we might think, simply because we've kind of seen this all before from Zimbabwe. We've seen a bit of a honeymoon period before. We even saw when Bangladesh started playing as a test nation, and they competed quite strongly. And what I think has been quite interesting about Zimbabwe is that they, for instance, in the last test, the way that they folded, so they were level after the first innings and then they completely folded. And it's the sense of being able to play well and to put good scores on the board when you're not under any pressure. But when you're actually in the position to win the game, not having the ability to close it out and to be ruthless. And actually, it's something that you see, I think, across sport generally, that often the newcomer does very well and then sort of falls behind.
It's sort of beginner's luck,
almost. And so I'm more tempted to kind of reserve judgments about Zimbabwe from the series. I think it does.
In my opinion, they've exceeded expectations. I mean, beating Bangladesh, they had no right really to beat a Bangladesh side that, you know, is much more experienced now over the last few years in the Test arena. And then to compete with Pakistan, I think, would you not say they've exceeded expectations?
Yeah, I have. I think they've done very well in this series. I'm just dubious about how much it says about the future. I do, though, think it says some interesting things about the future of Pakistan. It seems like this is the Pakistan side of old. There have been some wonderful moments and there have been some pretty dire moments as well. Mohammad Hafiz, I think, is a great, well, when you say prospect, he's kind of 30
now, isn't he? You're increasingly realising when you watch Pakistan that he's going to be very central to them as a side going forward, both with bat and ball. And I think it's been interesting to see someone like Izaz Chima come in, 32-year-old for his debut, and it's in, you know, obviously struggling to, in a sort of post-Asif, post-Amir, where's their bowling attack going? But perhaps, you know, obviously for Pakistan, you know, we expected them to win the series, so I don't know how much we've necessarily...
But what I have found quite interesting about, so we've talked about three series, we've talked about the England, India, the Sri Lanka, Australia, and the Zimbabwe, Pakistan, and what's been quite interesting about the three sides who haven't impressed in these series is that they don't actually seem to have all that many young players coming through. We talked about Sri Lanka having an essentially same team that they had in England and beforehand.
Yeah.
Pakistan actually are similar. I mean, so they're giving debuts to 32-year-olds. Mm. So they're discovering new talent in inverted commas. But how long is he going to be new talent for? Five years until his body packs in. And there aren't actually that many new players that are coming through for Pakistan. I mean, if you think about what a series against Zimbabwe means for any Test nation, it's an opportunity to give your unknown 21-year-olds who have never played Test cricket a chance to go out, play against a fairly easy bowling. The fact that Pakistan have been altogether emphatic against a side that has been, yeah, they might have exceeded expectations, but they haven't been great. Zimbabwe. Pakistan have done it with a side that isn't full of young talent. It's kind of their best test side, in a sense.
And you think that almost might be a subject of concern for them. I mean, away from the international arena, it's kind of an odd time to be talking about this because we are on the penultimate day of the county season, so the real battles are going to get resolved tomorrow. But, I mean, the one battle that has been resolved, and I'm quite excited about, Surrey will be playing Division 1 next year. Very sort of interesting project they've had going on there. There was this extraordinary... Well, Chris Adams' appointment as captain, as coach even, made an awful lot of sense. Very successful as a captain, obviously, at Sussex. But there was this extraordinary gamble of making the young, entirely inexperienced Rory Hamilton-Brown captain.
Particularly when you have the Ramprakashas in the side. I mean, that was the interesting dichotomy. Having a side that was potentially... Well, not even potentially, that was so full of experience and putting a kind of young whippersnapper in charge of them.
And I think, let's be frank, I don't think Surrey have often... They're not the neutral side in a lot of ways. I think they're often seen as almost the Man United of county cricket. Yep. They're seen as very wealthy and kind of... almost kind of arrogant towards the rest of the game. So I think quite a lot of people have taken pleasure in the struggles they've had, but it's come together really this year, both in the limited over stuff and in the county championship. And I think they should be encouraged. I think they've built a very exciting side. I mean, players like Jason Roy coming in and coming through there. Steve Davies, obviously the wicketkeeper, and they've played sort of very bold cricket, very aggressive, going for the wins, scoring consistently at a rate that is sort of doesn't really have a place in the county championship in a lot of ways.
I've we're recording here in London, and I've been down to the Oval to watch them this summer. Actually, the first time I went to the Oval, and I certainly really enjoyed watching them as a side. They've certainly got a good vibe about them. It was in a 4-day game, but they didn't. I mean, a lot of counties seem to approach, and the point system kind of encourages, seem to approach 4-day games in a kind of quite languid way, but they certainly had a sort of vigour about them.
And their promotion's actually been based on their ability to produce 4 wins on the trot, they're solid season. I mean, which team have you been pondering about?
I've just been really impressed by the way that in the first division. When I say I've been impressed by it, it hasn't sort of been caused by anything, but the way that the championship has kept on going right till the end. So at the moment, we've got Warwickshire at the top playing Hampshire at the bottom, both of them playing for points. Mm. You know, it's not a pushover game for Warwickshire, certainly. Similarly, got Somerset playing Lancashire. Lancashire obviously pushing for the title as well. Somerset pushing Salford.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, obviously, after the extraordinary drama of last year, where it all, you know, went into the final minutes of the season, you know, it's something that it can be really complimented on, this ability to throw out these close finishes. Mm. And I suppose, you know, the two-division system means that you've kept those bottom counties very interested, obviously, to preserve their status.
And, of course, as the season draws to a close, we look back over our managerial selections in our Telegraph fantasy.
Which of your fantasy players would you like to give a shout out to? Who have you been proud to have in the
sweepers? I've been very proud to have absolutely none of my players. They've been essentially totally useless in how they've been going on. My lack of transfer activity means that I've had, I think, six players who haven't scored for the last 5 weeks. But despite that, I'm very proud.
Because you've consistently transferred players out of your side who've then gone on to be very successful.
I have, exactly. It's kind of when I've rejected them that they've gone on to do rather well.
I've been quite impressed by Ryan Sidebottom having a bit of a grand finale to his sort of season. Picked up 7 wickets in the innings the other week, which bolstered my team somewhat. But I had to say my hopes of winning, you know, vast quantities of money on this fantasy program have somewhat fallen by the wayside.
Like all our hopes, really. So, from the archives, and this week we are in the same week as Sri Lanka and Australia have their tussle in the subcontinent. We are going back to the first time that Sri Lanka ever beat Australia.
And it's a bit surprising, this, isn't it? You asked me this. It's one of those cruel trivia questions.
Yeah, I did.
And, so Sri Lanka entered the Test arena in 83?
Listener, ask yourself when Sri Lanka first beat Australia. Okay, you probably all know and we're just ignorant. But I was very surprised to find out that it was in 1999, and such people as Chaminda Vaas, Mahela Jayawardena, Muralitharan, Jayasuriya were all playing the first time that Sri Lanka beat Australia, which I suppose goes to show a couple of things. Firstly, it goes to show how long those players have been around, of course. It goes to show how dominant Australia were in the Test arena during
and
that time.
And also, I suppose, the extent to which it did take Sri Lanka a while
exactly,
to get going in the Test arena.
To get going.
So actually, kind once of the rich man's
how strong they are now. It was a fascinating match. It was the first in a series in Sri Lanka, and it was marred by all kinds of fun and less fun events. It was down at Kandy, which should have told everyone that the pitch was going to spin, which is probably why Australia won the toss and rapidly put themselves into bat, not wanting to face Muralitharan on a fourth day wicket.
This has almost become sort of Muralitharan's sort of spiritual home, hasn't it? This is the
exactly.
pitch where, you know, Sri Lanka will open a series with give you Murali to face, and it's kind of all downhill from there.
Well, and they are indeed 60-7 in Australia in the first innings. Muralitharan goes on to take 4-63 eventually, and actually it's only down the order, Ricky Ponting batting at 6, who scores 96, who actually gets any runs at all. And
well, a very handy 40 from Jason Gillespie, actually. Yeah. 124 ball, 41. Even.
So his double century against the Bangladesh. Against the Bangladeshis later. That was built on solid foundations. Mm. So Australia make 188 in their first innings. Sri Lanka, in their reply, they're a team of, I mean, actually, a formidable batting lineup when you look down it. It's got Jayasuriya, Aravinda De Silva, probably the greatest Sri Lankan batsman of them all, Jayawardena, Ranatunga. They are helped in some way by a rather unfortunate incident where a ball falls between Jason Gillespie and Steve Waugh. Gillespie's running in from backward square leg, Waugh's running back, they neither of them call for it. They both end up being hospitalised. War breaks his nose. Gillespie breaks his leg quite horribly. There's a long break to the match while they're airlifted off. You kind of suspect it's not going to be Australia's day after.
No, I mean, that's extraordinary. And it's also, I mean, you do get the odd injury fielding, but it's fairly rare in cricket to get anything of that severity, isn't it, out in the field?
Absolutely. Despite this, I sort of feel that I'm saying this is a tactical advantage in some way, but Sri Lanka reached 234 in their innings. So they're actually only 60 ahead on first innings. This candy pitch is obviously taking turn. Muralitharan's taken four in the first innings. Warne takes five in the second innings. Australia go out to bat again, and they sort of fare a little better.
And it's interesting, because at this stage, Australia have still got a chance in this game, because they know if they can build a lead, they've got Warne to go out there in
why, when they won the toss, they decided to bat first, because they knew that Warne by 99 was pretty established as a fantastic leg spinner. When they go out to bat Australia in their second innings, they can't really set a target for Sri Lanka, so they're two men down. Steve Waugh, their captain, one of them, with a broken nose, is absent, hurt, as is Jason Gillespie, so the batting lineup is severely shortened. Once again, Muralitharan goes out, does the damage, 3 for 65. Perhaps even more impressive is Chaminda Vaas, who takes 3 for 15 at an economy of 1 and over.
It's interesting, because we were talking earlier about how weak this Sri Lankan bowling attack looks in the present day, and I think you sometimes forget quite how good a bowler Vaas was. I mean, we talk about how this candy pitch was really a Turner's pitch, and the fact that he's come out as a seamer and bowled so well.
Yeah.
I mean, to bowl 15 overs for 15 runs, you know, the mind boggles against a very classy batting lineup.
Absolutely. I mean, we've both had him in the... Well, I had him in my...
You had him in my camp side and you nicked him.
Yes, exactly.
With great success.
So we've both
so, Sri Lanka go in with 95 to get.
With 95 to get, and it's not altogether simple. They go about it, as you might expect, a team who is on the verge of their first win against the dominant side that Australia was at the time. They go about it with quite some timidity, and they find themselves at 39 for 3, and you kind of wonder whether Australia are going to manage to pull something out of the bag here. But Aravinda De Silva, the great statesman of Sri Lankan cricket, sees them home with a solid 31, and Ranatunga, another great old hand.
This game was quite useful for reminding both Toby and I of Colin Miller, who's quite probably, I can't think of a parallel now, who was able to both seam the ball early in the innings and then would make a reappearance later on in the game as an off spinner.
Exactly.
And which is a kind of party trick you don't really see. I can't think of a current player who does it.
If you want a good laugh, you should go onto his Cricket Info profile and just look at the picture. There's something...
It's very cruel thing to say. If you'd like entertainment, please go and look at Colin Miller's face.
Yes, exactly. Well, exactly. It's more the hair.
So Sri Lanka win the game by 6 wickets, and it goes on to set up a pretty significant series victory.
It does, because it's the only match in the series that actually ends in a result. But just so fascinating that Sri Lanka's first win against Australia comes so late on. I mean, remember that they've actually won the World Cup in 1995. It's just a symbol of the amazing dynamic of how strong that Australian side was. I mean, is it a hollow victory because two of the Australian players are out injured? I don't know.
I mean, I think by the Sri Lankans have already kind of by that stage, you know, dismissed Australia for 188. They've sort of grabbed the ascendancy in that game. I think the one thing is, do Sri Lanka's victories at Kandy become, you know, any less relevant? You know, the fact that you do prepare this track purely for your spinners, but then, I mean...
Purely,
you know,
for your Muralitharan, yeah.
Right, but then do you have a go at England for preparing the odd seaming track? I think it's sort of, you know, a justifiable home advantage.
¶¶
to the book review. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Australia 55 by Alan Ross.
Alan Ross was one of those wonderfully eclectic figures who you don't really get in journalism anymore, who had sort of done a bit of everything. He was a poet, he was a critic, he was an editor, he was a writer. And one of the wonderful things about this book, I think, is the way that it combines so many different types of writing. It's part cricket book, part travelogue, part social commentary.
He's very honest at the start. He describes it as a journal, and he says he describes it in that way basically to give him a justification to write about what he wants,
yeah, exactly.
Which is a rather nice sort of idea.
And so one of the great things about this book, I think, and I think you disagree here, is that you get a wonderful sense of how the tour pans out over time. So it's Ross. Basically, he writes this book on the back of having gone to Australia for the 1955 Ashes tour and the newspaper reports that he's written around it. But he writes this book, which brings in the newspaper report and his journal at the same time. And so you get a lot of his time spent on the ship, spent on the ship on the way over there.
Well, I mean, one thing that's interesting and why perhaps the journal format was really appropriate for this is that he has time on his side in a way that I don't think a modern journalist would. I mean, modern tours are much more compact.
Or a modern player, actually.
Yeah, no, quite right.
Because
this tour is altogether a very much a long-term thing. I mean, firstly, the fact that he spends three and a half weeks then,
yep,
going over on the ship.
That's
kind of a chapter in itself. And then the actual tour sort of unfolds at a very kind of civilised pace. The warm-up games go on for a few weeks. You know, and it's kind of in great contrast to now. You know, you get to a country, play a quick warm-up, get on with it.
But
it makes for a rather enjoyable read.
But there's also a difference between the way that the press and the players interacted, because he gets appendicitis when he's out there just after Christmas and he's in hospital, and there's a wonderful description of when Colin Cowdrey, who makes his England debut during this tour, and he's kind of the bright young England batting prospect, he is injured in one of the tests, and he goes into the same hospital, and they know each other straight away, and they have a wonderful conversation, and you realise that there's not the kind of divide. I mean, this wasn't in the day of press managers. The England side had a manager and someone who washed their kit, who went around with them and carried their bags, and that was it. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a press manager and all these barriers between the press and the team. And that's one of the things that Ross is very good at exploiting. I mean, exploiting is the wrong word, because he is genuinely good friends with these people.
Yeah.
It's that which makes his narrative rich.
As a writer, and I mean, in terms of, you know, the key fact that this is a book, Australia 55, that is seen as one of the great cricket books, I mean, crucially, it's a book that's lasted. You know, and I think that says something. I think it's the style that is the key here. Ross comes very much from the Carder school, that if you're going to write about cricket, then do it justice through beautiful prose. He goes consistently for sort of very elaborate language. And the funny thing is, I think we asked this question with Carder. We sort of said, well, would that now be seen as excessive? Almost today, would it be seen as kind of parody? But you read it today and you just think, God, what a pleasure. You know,
yep.
What a wonderful
and
thing
actually,
to see
one of the great things
treated with this respect.
One of the great things about Ross is that he doesn't let his sort of verbal flamboyance get in the way of what he's trying to say. There's this great quotation, which just a brief one, which is, for some while indeed, Favell kept his eyes averted from anything pitched outside the off stump with a modest concentration of a cleric about to encounter a streetwalker. But, like Oscar Wilde's famous character, he found the only thing he could not resist was temptation. And yes, of course, he's bringing in literature and he's being over the top in the way that he speaks, and he's kind of parodying himself in a sense. But it absolutely, for those of us who are encountering the series for the first time 56 years on, it's so eloquent about the way
that
it
works as well. You know,
it does.
It creates images that are effective. I mean, the other thing I like and I think I respect about the way he writes is he is willing to be unashamedly technical in his breakdown of the way bowlers and batsmen perform.
Yep.
He will break down shots, successful shots, weaknesses that the players have. And I think actually it's a frustration I think some of us who follow the game have with modern cricket writers. There's almost a fear to be nerdy. You
yep.
talk about it, you talk in generalities and stuff. And it's good to see an author who sees the game and sees its intricacy, sees its details,
and is delighted to be nerdy about
yeah.
it. What did you think about? So, one of the big aspects of this tour is the fact that they had so much time. At one point, he goes off and he spends 3 weeks exploring the Great Barrier Reef and staying in a hotel there. And in fact, there's a chapter which is entirely about that and has absolutely no mention of cricket in it whatsoever. What did you think of that aspect of it, the real travelogue aspect?
I'll be honest, I think I read, maybe perhaps because I came at the book really from a sort of cricketing angle, some of the travelogue dragged for me. I think it's not so much that it's necessarily poorly written, but I think perhaps what I was coming to the book, what I was looking for, was more the cricket. And I think some of the descriptions of the towns, to me, frankly, felt a little bit overwrought. What I would say was, you know, fascinating is the fact that, you know, for him, this really was a sort of full odyssey. You know, it was an adventure. It was a trip around Australia. Yep. And it, you kind of almost feel the jealousy of this extraordinary adventure.
But this is why I think the travelogue aspect of it is so important, that if you want to understand what touring was like in the 50s, then you can't cut out.
Do you see it as complementary to
the cricket? Yeah, I do, absolutely, because how can you understand a cricket tour and the way that a cricket tour works then if you cut out one of the most vital aspects of it, which was the fact... So, for instance, you get it on the ship going out, and when we were talking about the establishment of Sri Lankan cricket a couple of weeks ago, and the way that the way that Sri Lankan cricket was so strong before it started being a test nation was that people would play in Ceylon, as was obviously became Sri Lanka, would go out there and play in Ceylon, and it all became sort of part and parcel of the narrative of these cricket tours.
And I think it lent time for sort of analysis as well. I mean, it lent time for him before he got to the series to really contemplate the difference between the two sides. Funny anecdote, you know, it's always good to throw a funny anecdote into the book reviews. I particularly enjoyed the character on the boat who was forced to pay extra for his bathroom,
yes,
and decided to therefore just leave his water running the entire time. And the ship's clerk, quite justifiably, would come and say, you've left your bath water running again. And he would say, well, thanks for learning that. And he would go back and he would turn the taps on again. Yep. He had paid for it. So that was an amusing anecdote. You made the point that Ross's, or Alan Ross's, don't really exist anymore. Do you think it'd be possible for an Alan Ross to exist now, given the nature of the game?
I think it would be more difficult simply because cricket is a less languid sport. It's less commercial. It's less urgent in a way, because one of the great things you get about this book is that there's not really a sort of urgency about the whole thing. It's cricket as a luxury.
Mm. And you almost wonder, I was sort of wondering if, in a sense, the cricket mattered less. I mean, Ross cares. He's clearly a supporter of the England side, but he's maybe not fervent about it in the way... I don't know whether... he's maybe not as patriotic about... And I'm saying this almost as a positive, that he's not kind of... It's not seen as England's success is my concern. It's maybe a more sort of just general interest in cricket.
But there are a couple of things to say there, one of which is he's a journalist, he's not an England supporter.
Right.
And the second thing is that I do feel, I mean, and we could talk about this for hours, and unfortunately we don't have hours, but I do feel that he isn't necessarily indulging himself when he's talking about things outside cricket, because they are the thing that make up the rich tapestry that is cricket within culture in Australia. And also cricket within culture as was, so that when players went abroad, they didn't just go and turn up at the Gabba, play a test match and then leave. It was you went there, you took your family. I mean, all the players have their families out there. And that's what the experience of cricket was much broader, and the experience of being a cricketer.
It's certainly, I mean, it's a fascinating book, and I think in many ways it deserves the title of really a one-off. I can't really think of a natural comparison for it. Alan Ross's Australia 55. The one rather odd thing I found about this book, nobody seems to feel the need to put it back in print, which, given its popularity, seems
yes,
a bit of odd. Try to get hold of it for less than £40.
Well, exactly. It's some £40 on Amazon, but it is very much to be recommended. So, on to the debate. Bangladesh have had rather a torrid time against Zimbabwe recently.
A polite way of putting it.
One of the most high-profile results of that has been that Shakib Al-Hassan has lost his job as captain. Was that the right decision?
I'm going to do something very odd here and support the Bangladeshi Cricket Board. I think it has got to a stage with Bangladesh where they are literally setting a definitive new low in terms of their inability to develop as a side. And they needed to do something drastic. They need to do something bold. They need to show a response to this failure, frankly, which, you know, the failure in Zimbabwe is really just topping off what has been a persistent series of disappointments.
And is the captain responsible?
Right, so is the captain solely responsible? No. But I do think, and firstly, let's get started. I'm a big fan of Shakib Al-Hassan as a cricketer, and he's a fantastic, I mean, it's wrong, it's offensive to call him a prospect. He's a fantastic player.
Well, will this wreck his career? It's certainly going to mightily pee him off.
Well, I wonder. Firstly, I think there's an argument to say, given that he's, you could almost argue, their best player with both bat and ball often, that maybe the captaincy was, frankly, a kind of unwanted burden. I mean, maybe, let's just say, give someone else the captaincy, give him the chance to just play, give him the chance to carry the side. I think the idea with Shakib, when they made him captain, was that he would be a galvanising force on the side. It's not really clear that he's been able to do that. It's not really been clear that the side have responded to him. And I take your point, giving sole responsibility to Shakib is incredibly harsh. I mean, I'm going to ask you the impossible question here. What is wrong with Bangladeshi cricket? Why are things so dismal?
Where do you start? They don't have a decent domestic setup. I think is a major thing. They don't have a way of nurturing talent. They don't have a proper selection board. They don't have a proper board. They have a board that is full of bickering, infighting. I think those are all problems for any side who can't sort of play test cricket properly, as it were. But I just think it's slightly knee-jerk and slightly odd to have sacked someone. So they've sacked their captain and then they're going to have an inquiry. Why not have an inquiry, decide who's responsible, and then decide who to sack?
I think that's a fair point. And I also definitely don't think that this is going to be an instant sort of panacea. I don't think things are going to instantly get an awful lot better. But I do think things are getting very serious for Bangladesh cricket now. I think there's a growing force of people who believe, actually, they should become the first nation to actually be stripped of test status. And they need to try something new. I mean, I genuinely wonder, there's a core of players who they are persisting with, who I honestly question whether they're ever going to come good. Maybe what we need is even more radical surgery. Maybe, you know, you really need to overhaul this side.
It's difficult because I just don't think it's at the moment clear where the problem lies. There's this whole question of whether there's a kind of power struggle within the board, because there was this whole question about Al-Hassan has said that he wasn't consulted over selection, the board say that he was, all of these questions. I think they need to sort their house out before they cut off their nose to spite their face, potentially get their best player kind of despondent about the whole future.
If Shakib in some way, if he gets so disgruntled that we see him kind of going off into 2020 mercenary territory, then that would be a huge loss to the side. I mean, I think it's impossible for this debate not to kind of range into the bigger question of what's wrong with Bangladeshi cricket. And I think the real concern is that I struggle to believe that a country with this much passion for the game, with a very respectable population size, you know, you have a considerable pool of players to be picking, hasn't got the ability to do something in the game, you know, to be a reasonable force in the game. So something has to change. I agree, captaincy is a very minor thing. I think perhaps it does send maybe an important signal of a fresh start. But I agree with you to the extent that the changes have got to be far-reaching, and frankly, they've got to be quick.
Because I wonder slightly whether it is the board covering their backs, because they have created a scapegoat in Shakib, and as long as you have a scapegoat, then it means that it doesn't go any further.
It's an extraordinary allegation saying that a cricket board would blame players rather than take responsibility themselves.
Because it's never happened anywhere else, has it? Anyway, on that note,
thank you very much for joining us for the 19th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, in which we'll be talking about how things panned out in Sri Lanka, how things panned out in England, and looking forward to a pretty exciting winter where the new Test number one side will get their status thoroughly tested.